One alternative is to accept that there will be drastic change that we can neither predict nor control. The other alternative is to pretend that 2 and 2 is not equal to 4. Welcome to the future. That's not the subject I'm talking about. I do, in a book that I'll be mentioning, which is currently webbed, and that I hope some of you will look at. This is not going to work. In a book that is currently on my website that I hope I'll get some of you to look at, because it's up there for comments, I do try to discuss the very interesting question of whether technological advance can make us worse off. And I argue that there are circumstances in which that can happen. I'm not sure there's a whole lot you can do about it other than hoping we don't end up with those circumstances. But again, that's not my topic for the moment. I may end up having to give this talk without the advantage of PowerPoint if the machine was working just fine half an hour ago, but we will see what happens. We may be making progress. Nope, no signal. This is plugged to here. This is plugged to here.
Still a back person.
This.
Display.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. Just a minute. Just tech display.
No. Go here.
Sorry. Here. Just a tech.
Turn on mirroring.
Turn on mirroring. Right. Let's see if that does it. No. Now we try detect display. Where was detect display? There was a detect display. All right, let's see. Display. Detect displays.
Do they have the signal on to the right thing?
Voila.
Gotta push
progress.
It in.
Progress. Just a minute. I'm not sure if I need that. Let me. You're sure? Sorry. What? It's mirroring. It's mirroring. I'm not planning to restart. No, thank you. I am just planning to find PowerPoint where it happens to be, and PowerPoint open, and PowerPoint file. Come on. Yeah, got it. File and nano presentation. And now if I just tell it to play a slideshow, with luck, this is going to work. Amazing. Amazing. All right, I'm going to be talking about the nanotech economy. I am not going to be talking about whether we will all be unemployed. We've run this experiment already. Making societies much more productive does not result in everybody being unemployed because there is essentially no limit to human wants. There is a limit to the number of pounds of food we want, but not the amount of quality of food or quality of transport or quality of life or any of lots of other things. So as we get more productive, we take some amount of additional leisure, some amount of additional consumption. We don't necessarily all get fat, although that's one possible outcome. We won't be all employed, unemployed. Not are we all going to be rich, though we might be. What interests me is the question of how the economic structure of that society is going to be different. Now, nanotech is a term which gets used for lots of things, broader and narrower. And it turns out that there's a very, very simple way of making a term have broad meaning. Offer enough money for it, and the definition expands accordingly. If we offer enough money for nanotech research, we'll get it up to a meter. Nanotech, broadly defined, is making very small things. That might let us live longer, it might get us into space, it might do lots of other interesting, nice things, but it's not economically interesting. What I am interested in is nanotech in the sense that some of us originally met it, thanks to Drexler mostly. That is to say, molecular assembly. the economics of advanced nanotech. And let's think about that world. The world we live in is a whole lot of small Legos called atoms. A Drexlerian assembler is a very small kid, small enough to pick up atoms and assemble them. Once you have one assembler, you have as many assemblers as you want. Because once you have one assembler, one of the things it can do is to build another assembler, and they can build two, and so forth, and so on. Atoms are cheap. All right, that's that half, 50 cents a pound, or whatever anybody was quoting. That seems a little expensive for dirt, which is largely aluminum, but I don't mind. On the other hand, designing a car with every atom in the right place is expensive. So those are, I think, the fundamental facts of this economy. And we already have an economy that's just like that. That's the software economy. The first copy of Microsoft Word cost a lot to produce. We can argue about value, but we know about cost. And the second copy cost essentially nothing. Books are a similar pattern, not quite as extreme, because printing is still more expensive than reproducing on floppy disks, but if you're willing to read your book on the screen, where it's exactly the same story. All right. What are the consequences of that kind of economic situation? What are the consequences of a software economy? And the first set is that you have a natural monopoly, that the more nanotech cars you make from your one design, the lower the average cost. You only have to design it once. And that's going to give you the pattern we observe in software, which is a pattern of sequential competition. That is to say, if you actually look at software niches, and there's an interesting book which discusses this question, what you observe is that there tends to be a dominant product at any one, but that what that product is changes over time. Because, although if the current dominant product is as good as anything else, then it can be cheaper because you're making more copies. But on the other hand, if somebody else comes up with something a little better, he can take the whole market away in 6 months because it's cheap to make additional copies of the program. And that's essentially the pattern that we're used to seeing in the software economy. There's a second pattern that we also observe there and can expect to observe this world, and that's the pattern of what economists call monopolistic competition. And being an old-fashioned sort of first one, let me show you the traditional story of monopolistic competition. Those of you of a certain age will realize that this is an antique lifted from the earliest age of computers. This is a program drawn with MacPaint, which came with the first Macintosh. It's out of a textbook of mine. You've got a set of barbershops along a street. Customers are lazy. So at equal prices, the customer will go, that's not me, I'm still seeing it. That's not at this end. My screen is still just fine. So, what? All right. So at equal prices, people will go to the nearest barbershop. On the other hand, each barbershop can compete for the people who are halfway in between by offering a lower price. So you get what turns out to be quite an interesting economy. You can analyze it mathematically. It's one of the few things other than perfect competition and pure monopoly where you can actually get solutions. And you get competition essentially at the margins with a core in the middle. And what we observe in contexts like software is the same thing, except that instead of physical space, as in my barbershops, what we have is competition in characteristic space. I, for example, am sitting very, very close to the barbershop that's operated in Cupertino by Apple Computer. So if they raise their prices 10%, I still won't start thinking about getting a Windows machine. Other people are close to the interface between those two, and as prices go up or down, they will choose between them. So what you would expect, again, with this technology where average cost falls forever with quantity, is that you would have a dominant product in each location in characteristic space, each particular set of characteristics, one very safe car with a particular set of characteristics, one very stylish car, probably several because there are different tastes in the market, and so forth. And you might see the same process at the component level. It may well be that rather than paying the cost of designing a car, what you actually do is you license the motor from one manufacturer and the wheels and the windshield from others and so forth. You're licensing your designs, of course, for nanotech manufacturers. Right? I like to imagine the way you build a car is you dig a pit in the backyard and you stir stuff up a little and dump a few things in and you throw in your assemblers and you dump in a little gasoline because they need some energetic molecule to disassemble and you go away and in the morning there's your car sitting there. Sort of the way we make oak trees, only faster. And I know these people like these complicated factories and stuff. But that's just an intermediate stage because once you've really got the technology right, your molecular machines can go out and pull elements out of the dirt and do the whole job themselves. But that's a digression. Anyway, we observe in the book market that there are far more books published than any one person reads, despite the fact that the average cost of books goes down the more copies you make, and the reason is because there are different people like different books. So that's what that economy looks like. I want to go on to the second set of consequences, which come from a different feature also shared with software. I want to assume that we have not only assemblers, but disassemblers. Now, once I have a nanotech object, micro or macro, I can convert the object back into the design. Take it apart and keep track of the atoms. And once I know exactly how that car was assembled, now my software writes the instruction tapes for my assemblers, and next week there are 50 shiny new cars in my showroom, all looking exactly like the one that I bought, available to be sold. Now, there may be ways of solving this problem. As everybody knows, there have been various attempts at technological protection of software. And one possibility that occurs to me in the case of hardware is that a really complete description of a car, every single atom, is going to take an awful lot of memory, even with all of the nanotech devices that Eric can think up. I don't think we're going to do it. All right? That's, 6 times 10 to the 23rd for Avogadro's number times however many, about 1 million grams roughly, so that's 6 times 10 to the 26th, something on the order of 10 to the 26th atoms. Takes a lot of storage. So the way you're really going to describe the car is in a compressed form. All right, you've got a formula which gives you a little tiny bit of the windshield, and then you tell how many times you repeat it, just like we compress stuff on software now. So maybe you can make a car such that you can't disassemble it because you can't figure out the compressed form well enough to get it into a reasonable amount of storage. Maybe. Suppose that doesn't work. That's not interesting. All right, I like to make assumptions that make the world interesting. So suppose that doesn't work. We now have a world where you can Xerox a car. All right, and anything else, any physical object, any nanotech macro or micro object. And this raises an old problem, which is how does the guy who puts in the very large costs of the original design get himself paid? All right. How do you get paid to create the first copy when whoever buys it can make as many copies as he likes and sell them at a lower price than you are planning to sell them? And there are a bunch of possible solutions that we've observed in the world in various contexts. And the obvious possibility is intellectual property protection, that I have a right to forbid you from copying my car. A second one, which I'll be discussing in a minute, is a customized product. The third is tie-ins. And a fourth that was mentioned a little while ago is open source. Let's start with intellectual property protection. Everybody but me, I think, who talks about intellectual property in nanotech is worried about patents. But patents in nanotech really raise exactly the same issues as patents in everything else. The interesting thing about nanotech is copyright. Because what we're really concerned with is not the person who steals your clever idea for how to assemble atoms to do X, Y, or Z. That's just the old patent problem. What we're really worried about is the person who actually copies your car. All right? That's just like copying a book. So I think what you would want is something like copyright. We already, I should say, have this. As everybody knows, the existing forms of nanotech are biological. We have a Plant Patents Act, which gives you something that really looks more like copyright than patent at present. So then the question, as with all intellectual property law, is how easily you can enforce it. And the general rule from history is that if copying requires a big, expensive thing located somewhere invisible, like a printing press, then you can enforce copyright law. Because then, whoever is copying, you can find him. He's out there selling copies of your book that he's pirated. He's got assets. You can sue him. So it's at least possible to enforce intellectual property law. The easier copying gets, the harder it becomes to enforce intellectual property law, as in the obvious case of software. And that at least suggests, now it's true that more advanced nanotech also means more complicated designs, but on the whole, my guess is that the more advanced the nanotech gets, the more nearly it's something that anybody can do, and if it's something that anybody can do, it's very hard to prevent people from copying. So that probably limits that. Next is my idea for a customized product. It's a wonderful car, nanotech car. They just produced it. It's shiny. It's new. It burns anything, everything. The windshield's made of diamond. It's got safety devices you wouldn't believe. You don't even need a key. The steering wheel checks your fingerprints, checks your DNA. You'll never miss a few dead skin cells. When you want the door to unlock, you say, "Open Sesame." It knows your voice. You are the key. You can make a copy for a friend if you like. And what have you made him? You have made him a very large paperweight because you're the only person in the world who can drive that car. So that is one model of a way in which you might solve the intellectual property problem without intellectual property protection. And in fact, it's one of the ways we do at the moment. There are these large legal databases, which essentially every lawyer in the country pays money to get access to, in which you do a search for cases. And after I've done a search for cases and I've downloaded all of the information about past cases relevant to the particular lawsuit I'm involved in, I can print out a copy and give it to a friend. But of course, it won't be any use to my friend, unless he's working on my case, because he wants a different set of information. So that's essentially a case where you already have a solution to the problem that you can't keep people from copying the information by giving them tailored information which is relevant only to them. Tie-ins are another possibility. This time it's a generic car. You didn't have to pay it. They're giving these cars away. Anybody can drive it. The only minor detail is that when you turn the car on, the ads go on too. All right? And they're not in your way. They don't play them on the windshield, but everywhere else on the car and in through the sound system, and it's all a network at the molecular level through the car. You can't take it out. And that, after all, is how we pay for web pages. I like to claim that I predicted the dominant business model on the World Wide Web. Because in a book that is copyrighted 1973, I discussed the question of how markets deal with products that are too cheap to be worth charging for. And I said, suppose in the automated hospitals of the future, medical care is so cheap it's not worth charging for. There will be billboards on the insides of those hospitals advertising whatever goods are still worth selling. So that's what the web does. I just had a few of the details wrong. There are other tie-ins you can imagine, such as selling support for your product, providing upgrades for your product without the trouble of finding them and getting them from somebody else, and so forth. In general, a tie-in can be anything that can be best produced by the designers of the car and then sold. And then finally, there's the possibility of open source production to people doing designs for the fun of it, because they want the end product, or for any of a variety of indirect benefits, which I don't have time to go into, but The Magic Cauldron by Eric Raymond is somewhere up on the web, and Eric's one of these wonderful, crazy people who has interesting ideas. We've heard one or two others here. Well, I thought I ought to say a little bit about the downside of nanotech. Other people have discussed this. Ralph Merkel has several times come to give me guest lectures at my seminar at the law school at Santa Clara, and every time he spends his guest lecture explaining to my students why we need government regulation of nanotechnology. Now, some of you may be surprised that Ralph would do this, but after a couple of times it got through to me, I'm a little bit slow, that he had something he wanted me to do, namely write an answer to that argument, which I have done. Advanced nanotech is here. Now, any teenage American geek can turn the world to gray goo. And I know gray goo isn't the latest thing at Foresight. They've now got better and newer ways of destroying the world. But the basic point is there, that you have to worry about a technology powerful enough so that people can do a great deal of damage. And there are basically two models of defending against such things. One of them is the way we defend against foreign nations by governments, treating defense as a public good. And the other is the way we currently defend against computer viruses, treating defense as a private good. That, after all, the amount of money people will pay not to be killed is enormously larger than the amount of money people will pay to kill other people. The only exception, there's only one exception, and that's when people were paying at our defense departments. Then it's about even. But as far as market activity is concerned, if the offense has a big enough advantage over the defense, we're dead. All right? I don't see an answer to that. Because once you get a fully developed nanotech, I don't think there is any real way of controlling it. And besides, world government is just going to get us dead anyway, just in a slightly different way. So as long as the offense doesn't have a huge advantage over the defense, though, then what you want is a vibrant, lively market producing the sorts of things that we've heard about in the nanomedicine context, that is, stuff that in one way or another will defend people against the more likely attacks. And I would go back to the point that Kurzweil made, which I intend to steal for future talks, of comparing the response time of a drug industry regulated by the FDA to the response time of the people who currently provide antivirus defenses. One of them is in years, and one of them is in hours. Right. Choose one. All right, let me go back a minute. We have two models of defense. It's tempting to say, we'll do everything. We don't have that option. If protection against nano-attacks is being done by government, it is going to be done by an attempt to stringently regulate private nanotech, because that's the obvious way to say you can only have your nanotech device if we've checked that it meets the Foresight guidelines, and maybe not even then. We'll have our nanotech work all done in licensed government official this and that, and half of them will belong to the Defense Department. And that regulation is going to mean that we are going to have a whole lot lower level of private defenses, and again, consider Kurzweil's point. Now, this has been a very short version of what I have to say, probably about the same length as when I gave it 17 years ago, with less content at the first time I was at a Foresight conference. However, for the longer version, I have a book which my agent is supposed to be finding me a publisher for, so far unsuccessfully. And it's been webbed for a while. If you go to my webpage, www.daviddfriedman.com, which has got lots of other fun stuff on it as well, you will find a link to Future Imperfect. And that's a draft of a book. And the chapter on nanotech has this stuff. There's lots of other stuff. The draft is actually sitting on my adult son's webpage because he wrote some commenting software and he wanted something to try it on. So you can add comments to any sentence of the draft, and I will eventually see them. In terms of other stuff up on the web page, I should say that a previous speaker mentioned all the odd things people are going to do when they have enough free time. Well, historical recreation actually happens to be one of mine. And it occurred to me while he was talking about people spending their time, you know, doing odd things, that in the last few weeks I've built three Anglo-Saxon lyres based on the reconstruction of the one at Sutton Hoo. I read the book chapter by the guy who reconstructed the Sutton Hoo lyre. I regret to say he's the same guy who first reconstructed the Sutton Hoo harp, but I think he got it right the second time, and it's been lots of fun. So, indeed, people do lots of weird things when they've got a little free time and energy and stuff. Thank you all.